Hello, Marian Galevich here from the EIN eLearning Editorial Board. We would love your feedback on EINcast, Weekly Neurology. Please help us to learn more about you, our listeners, and plan the future of EINcast by taking our short survey. If you do, you can enter our prize draw for the chance to win free registration for the EIN Congress 2025 in Helsinki. The survey will be online until the end of December 2024. Just look for the link in the episode description. And now, we hope you enjoyed today's episode.
Welcome to EINcast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EINcast, Weekly Neurology. My name is Vanessa Carvalho, and I'm a neurologist and member of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Coordinating Panel. This month's topic is Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and today's episode will be on sex and gender differences in Parkinson's disease. My guest today is Professor Angelo Antonini. He is a full professor of neurology at the University of Padua and a fellow of the European Academy of Neurology. During his career, he has received several awards and has published over 600 papers. He has been an invited speaker at several national and international neurology congresses, and he's a leading figure in movement disorders. Welcome, Professor Antonini, and thank you for joining us today.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Vanessa, for getting me on board. Thank you.
So, Parkinson's disease is the second most common neurodegenerative disorder and is the fastest growing one. And when we think about Parkinson's disease, we still view it as a predominantly male disorder. Do recent studies still support this notion we have?
I think this is a very important point to address. And in fact, I think most of the documents that we like to refer to include this evidence, apparently, from epidemiology studies, indicating that somehow there are the proportion of men is about 20% or 30% higher than female. Now, the question really is, I think, if these data have been properly collected. And this data don't take into account also people who are maybe older than 70 who may not be immediately referred to movement disorder unit. So what we did in my region with the regional authorities in an area of approximately 5 million people, we checked how many visits for Parkinson were performed in this region. And we found that the total number was approximately 18,000 last year, 2023, so 1-8. And 18,000, the number was slightly higher for men, but the difference was very modest. So eventually, if you go and take the medical records and people who are got a certification, medical certification to be Parkinson, the number is not that different. There are slightly more men younger than 50, 55, and there are more women older than 60, 65. This is in part related also to the differences in life expectancy. But certainly two interesting points, I think, even for people, for young people pop up. So it seems then the lifespan until the menopause below 50, the prevalence seems higher in men. But after that age, there are many more women getting affected. I know that this concept may look a bit obsolete about the estrogen role, but certainly there is maybe an hormonal effect on brain function that makes apparently, slightly less likely for women, for young female, to be affected compared to young males. So if I have to summarize this concept, I think the literature is a bit biased in favor of men. if you go to real life data, epidemiology data collected through the official regional authorities' medical records, I think it's close to 50% each.
Thank you, Professor Antonini. That's very interesting. Do you think that maybe also the different presentations might also lead to underdiagnosis of females?
I think there are, one thing is the clinical manifestations, but I think also there is a bit of a bias due to the fact that women may be very much looking after themselves, but when there is a disease, sometimes they don't have a man to take them to the hospital, while the opposite is more likely. So that the woman is very attentive to any minimal change in the person she's living with, if it's a man. And that man, of course, is taken to a visit much earlier. So I think one factor has to do with certainly the existence of a predisposition for a female to look after men rather than the opposite, which drives male to be brought to the doctor earlier and possibly when they have a very modest signs. In the case of women, sometimes, especially if they are young, I see they can endure relatively clinically meaningful symptoms without, complaint. So this is another aspect that may lead to a delay in diagnosis. And also, I think there is in women, there is a higher proportion of women who complain about emotional distress, anxiety, depression. So they may be seen by the wrong specialist. So they may be sent first to be seen by a psychiatrist rather than a neurologist. So that all of this added together brings, I think, to a relatively late diagnosis.
Thank you. And because we are seen by a very young audience, can you walk us through the main differences of the presentation of PD in the different genders? Because I know there are some data about this.
Well, there are data, again, maybe we can discuss with you, which, if you think that these data are reliable, the differences in the motor manifestation, for instance, is there more bradykinesia and rigidity in men compared to women? There is more tremor maybe in women sometimes. I don't know how reliable these data are, to be frank. I'm pretty much aware of the fact that looking at symptoms that are not related to mobility, like anxiety, depression, mood changes, they may be more frequent early on in women compared to men. But in terms of mobility, I think the data are not that solid to claim that, the more rigid and kinetic are the men. Is that what you had?
Yes, that was what I was thinking about. And also the cognitive presentation and the gait?
Well, the gait, again, men are more likely to have more rigidity. So generally, there may be more gait and balance problems early on in men. But women are more likely to develop dyskinesia. So they may also have under the effect of levodopa, gait and balance problems. So I think we need to be careful in providing these strict categories to a specific gender or sex, simply because the bias always relates to the person who's doing the observation and your population. What the question we should ask ourselves is, what I see in my clinic, is it representative of the total Parkinson population or not? Because it may not be. We have little evidence that in many cases, a movement disorder neurologist really sees the true spectrum of Parkinson's disease, because many patients older than 60, 65 in many countries may be seen by geriatricians, for instance. And this is true in the UK, maybe in Germany, in Italy, Spain. So there may be a proportion of patients who are not seen by the dedicated center, dedicated institution.
Thank you. And you spoke about dyskinesias, that women have more dyskinesias. Do you know if there is any robust evidence about sex and gender differences in the response to treatment?
Yeah, I think there is a difference. And I must say that the magnitude of response of women is greater generally than men. So in the first years, especially in young women, thanks to better brain plasticity and adaptation, I think the magnitude of benefit is larger. But then, you know, because we are providing medications orally and it is hard to titrate exactly the dose, and we will come back to this when we discuss the clinical trials, if there is a bias in clinical trials. I think because the dose maybe is slightly or relatively too high in women, and thanks to this plasticity in the brain, they tend to develop involuntary movements, so movements that can no longer be suppressed by volition, and that makes women more keen on developing postural instability and falls, because the instability and falls affect both the on but also the off part. So both parts are affected. And if you take your medications and you are not optimally treated as a woman, then the risk of falling may be relatively high, even if you have idiopathic Parkinson.
Thank you, Professor Antonieri. And you mentioned clinical trials, and that it's also something I would like to ask you, if we have data regarding inclusion in clinical trials, if there is any bias, and what are the consequences of this bias?
Well, I think that if you go back to studies, registrative studies in the last 20, 30 years, in Parkinson's disease, I think the majority of people who were enrolled were men. So this, of course, goes under the assumption that men and women have similar processes, but we know this is not exactly true. So that you need to validate not so much the efficacy, but the adverse events of specific drugs in women in order to make sure that the dose you are providing and the adverse events that may be triggered by that drug are similar or different. And I think they are different. One adverse event that we see with levodopa, of course, is dyskinesias. Dyskinesias are definitely more pronounced in women, especially young women compared to young men. So this is, as I said before, may be related to differences in connectivity, post-transcriptional changes. But certainly, the current evidence indicates that it would be best to have a balanced enrollment where you have men and women equally enrolled in a population to test a specific drug. Of course, we haven't discussed the reasons. I don't know if you are interested in this, but there are, I think, some social reasons for this. In the environment, of course, similar to the early diagnosis, I think that it is more likely that a woman drives a man to participate every month to an experimental therapy rather than the opposite. So I think that there is also this factor. So we have more data, not only at baseline, but we have also more people coming into clinical trials. So we have more people, men who are maybe seen by the doctor more often than a woman. So all this brings to insufficient evidence of treatment for many drugs that we use in clinical practice for women, including the dose. I mean, imagine levodopa. Levodopa was tested in men, and the doses of levodopa you have are the same if you are 2 meter tall or 1 meter 55 woman. So we don't have doses that can be really adjusted to the weight of the person. We have just one macro dose, and we try to fit this macro dose to people who are physically very different, 2-3 fold more weight and body mass in a tall man compared to a short woman. I think it is something which should be taken into account.
And for instance, you think we should start with smaller doses for females, for a standard female patient, for instance?
I totally agree. But that's what I do. I mean, I start with low doses and I try to be much more careful when I raise the dose, because I know that if dyskinesias appear, they are a sort of hallmark of the of plasticity and dysfunctionality, that once it's there, you cannot get rid of that, because it's a way to communicate between cells. So I think we need to pay special attention in terms of doses to women, starting with a low dose and then increasing slowly compared to men.
Thank you. I also wanted to ask you, because we talked about also younger patients and younger females, and we know women with Parkinson's disease of childbearing age are not so frequent, but these patients do exist. What kind of evidence we have on pregnant women, what kind of medication we can give these patients, and if we have any registries?
Yeah, you made touched a very good point, and a point which I've been arguing and discussing many times in the past. I have a publication of a couple of women who got pregnant under treatment with levodopa and pramipexole. And it was more than 20 years ago. At that time, pramipexole had not been tested in pregnant women. And generally, as you know, in all clinical trials that we run, want to make sure that you are not carrying a child, and you need to take a pill to make sure that you don't get pregnant if you participate to such a trial. So that has led to absolutely only anecdotal evidence of medications that are prescribed or can be utilized by a pregnant woman. So the right of women to have children contrasts a bit with the fact that in the case of Parkinson, it has been a bit neglected, the idea of testing or validating the efficacy of these drugs during pregnancy. And there is no active monitoring of newborns. I mean, I'm not saying that the drugs are toxic, but I'm saying let's monitor that, let's collect data. Well, this data don't exist. So this is a cause of concern. I mean, there are case reports like the one that we published a few years ago on pregnancy and pramipexole. I think you can refer to that, but there is no call center or something people could ask an official entity to ask in these conditions, which is a period of high fragility, because, of course, getting a baby, maybe the first, second time of your life, carrying the baby, delivering, you are worried about the potential toxicity of the drugs. We certainly know that there is no major adverse event associated with this condition, with the last months of pregnancy and delivery. But yes, I think it's a great topic and it would deserve a discussion.
Thank you so much, Professor Antonini. So we don't have much time left, and I would also like to ask you about biomarkers. So this year has been, in the past years, there has been a lot published about alpha-synuclein through immune assays. Do we have any data on gender differences on biomarkers in Parkinson's disease?
Well, you are talking about wet biomarkers. Imaging studies instead have not shown differences in dopaminergic denervation, or MRI hasn't shown differences in structural differences. Regarding the expression of synuclein, I think there is not clear evidence of a difference, but this is highly unexplored because it's a topic which requires a large data. I mean, the all studies carried out so far have not been able to show any gender effect. But again, they may be biased by the fact that some people didn't simply participate, or maybe they were referred by centers who were not leading centers in the region. So I think that the idea of using the biomarkers and validating those biomarkers in a mixed population is very good, is very important. Of course, the number of cases we may need to do a full analysis is pretty large. So I think we need more time. So far, I think the expression of synuclein in the periphery, in the blood, in the skin, in other organs is pretty similar.
Thank you. And may I ask you, what are the challenges we need to address, and what should we, as researchers and clinicians, should focus to improve the lives of women living with Parkinson's disease?
Well, I think women represent the largest majority of humans in the planet, so there's a very good reason to look after women, and because we are all born from a woman, so we need to be very caring the health of women, which are driver of the society. So I think in this sense, there is no need to list the billions of reasons why we should be performing studies, or we should be paying sufficient attention to the women enrolled in clinical trials. Just a few in the case of Parkinson, the delay in diagnosis I mentioned, the fact that they may suffer from greater emotional distress. Then there is a sense of failure for a woman who's maybe doing some homework, looking after the family, working outside in the business. Combining everything becomes difficult. Frustration may be higher in women than compared with men. And also the effect of drugs may vary. The disease may manifest with more limbic symptoms, but the motor distress will be similar. But testing the efficacy of the drugs in women is important. So you want to make sure that they recover to full benefit, because they deserve it. You know that they are at home. They will probably do two or three jobs looking after the family and doing their own job. So the quality of sleep, the need of care, these are all items that we need to be special, that should be special in our mind when we start treatment in women.
So thank you, Professor Antonini. You gave me a lot to think about. Today's episode is coming to an end, and I'll thank you for joining us today. And I'll briefly summarize some of the main points we discussed today. So real data contradicts the notion that Parkinson's disease is a predominantly male disorder. We see differences in the response to medication, and we should be mindful of this when we have a new patient in our clinic. Also, we see an underrepresentation of women in clinical trials, and we should focus on bridging this gap and also looking at future registries to look at safety of medication in young women with Parkinson's disease who want to become mothers. And these are the main messages I would
I can add this one last point we haven't discussed in details regards more the invasive treatments, the brain stimulation and infusion therapies. Also there is a topic, we have just submitted an article indicating that there is insufficient representation of women for these invasive treatments. So this is very important. And I think in clinical trials and in studies, there should be balanced enrollment. So I would pledge the fact that we are not only looking at, you know, ethnic minorities, but also to have a balanced enrollment, because this would provide balanced data and would make the effect of a specific drug or an invasive treatment more visible for women.
Thank you, Professor Antonini, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.